Well, hello and greetings from Tokyo, Japan. It's Citizen Reporter. It's me, Mark Fonseca Rendeiro, aka Bicycle Mark. And yes, indeed, it is a visit to Japan. What am I doing in Japan? Well, first of all, why wouldn't anybody take a chance to come to Japan? And above all, I'm here to visit the great Matthew Donce. If you're a longtime listener of this program, or even a recent listener, you've heard Matthew on these airwaves. I'm doing air quotes with airwaves because it's all podcasting. But you've heard him talking about his struggle to live longer, to fight cancer long enough to give him time with his family. And I decided it's high time I came to Tokyo, came here to spend time with my friend, and I've been able to do that. And of course, if Matthew and I spend any time together, there's going to be a recorder. That's not my metro, but there goes a metro. Anyway, so on today's program, we're in Shibuya. I'm walking around with Matthew Donce, and you can go to MatthewDonce.org to help support him, to help keep him alive. He thanks you, I thank you, his family thanks you. And now let's go learn. We're going to learn about Japan, the culture as it relates to work, and the unique view that Japan may have when it comes to how an economy works and how a country could work. Let's see, for posterity's sake, the date is October
23rd or something.
That sounds good. October 23rd, 2017. Let's go over the location. Tokyo, but more specifically.
We're in Shibuya.
At the top of a skyscraper.
It's called Tokyo Hikarie.
Yeah. Are we 11? No. You pressed an 11.
Yep. This is the 11th floor. The highest we can go, sadly, in this building.
Yeah, and the voices you hear, I'm Mark, Bicycle Mark sometimes, and especially since we're talking to Matthew today, I'll go with my original online name that some people still remember, and other people don't, Bicycle Mark, and Matthew Donce is here. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, we're talking into a cube today, which is probably not that different from what we normally talk into.
It's quite surreal, and probably you're going to get quite tired holding this cube.
It's so light.
But it's the future.
You think so? I find that recorders don't really evolve, at least not quickly enough for me, in terms of the options and the portability. I'm looking forward to the invisibility of recorders, and not in a sinister way, just to help people relax and be able to talk to one another without remembering the device so much.
But I mean, this recorder is kind of feels almost like it's just a microphone, but it's not. Right, it's got storage and presumably a little microcontroller or single board computer in there. But yeah, it has the feel of this is just a microphone.
Yeah. And so we've come here to Shibuya in Tokyo, and one of your main messages to me is that not only this area, which is interesting, but also that this city has something very special, worth being around, whether it's as a visitor or perhaps even as a resident, no matter where you come from, that Tokyo is perhaps one of the most exciting places that you've ever known.
Yeah, and it's weird being in Japan at the moment, particularly for me, because I'm a very negative and cynical person, and things in Japan seem to be going really, really well, and it's not doesn't feel like it's some kind of bubble like we had in the 1980s when I wasn't here, but you know, there's a massively overvalued economy here. People are spending money in insane ways, and it just doesn't feel like that at the moment. and particularly in Shibuya. So Shibuya is kind of shifting from, you know, the past of, I guess, almost 15 years when the big focus has been on the youth economy, particularly high school girls. Mm-hmm. And high school girls here now have a lot less economic power, a lot less spending money. So of course, Japan has a rapidly aging population.
Well, that's something I definitely want to get to when it comes to saying that, you know, Japan is doing so well. That aging population thing is a very interesting question, especially for me as an armchair sociologist and also an aging human. But before that, quickly on the high school girl economy, I mean, that means selling of what? I mean, once upon a time, music, but that's not a thing.
Music.
Exactly.
So cell phones were the big thing, right? The high-end cell phone. This is before smartphones. The high-end cell phones costing $700 that had to be changed regularly for fashion purposes, not feature purposes. So, you know, that's kind of shifted a lot. Clothes, jewelry.
Nothing so different from what you might see anywhere in the world.
Exactly, except for the monetary values. So, you know, people here buying a purse or something for several hundred dollars when they're like a 15-year-old girl.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to imagine that outside of Japan, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's something about Japan that I definitely feel as a visitor coming from, I guess, Europe. That the cost of living appears high initially, especially if you don't know where to go to find good prices or competitive prices. It often feels like, oh, the cost of some food, I know not all food, can be quite expensive. The cost of even transportation, if you rely on the trains, it definitely adds up. And I didn't compare it so much with other countries, but it feels like an expensive place to live, but I suppose people earn accordingly.
They earn accordingly, and also I think the big thing here is housing is a lot cheaper than people think. Even in Tokyo, I'm coming from the UK where housing is cripplingly expensive. You are coming from a walkable city. Right, and you know, I guess your main mode of transport is on foot or by bicycle. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're here, particularly when you're here visiting, you do tend to, you clock up a lot of kilometers on the trains.
Yeah.
So then it does feel like the cost is quite high. One interesting thing is in Japan, the company has to pay the transport cost for the employee.
So there's your salary, and then there's your
transport cost, which they will usually pay in the form of a monthly train pass called a teiki, which is like for a set route and a set train line. Most people in Tokyo, they think about geography in terms of train stations. So when you describe where you live, you always think about what your nearest station is. When you meet someone, you'll always meet them at the train station. It's starting to change now because of Google Maps. But still, it very much, you know, you'd never ask someone to come to your house for the first time. It'd always be you'll meet them at the nearest train station. And when you're choosing somewhere to live, it's always how close is the train station. Whereas in England, train stations are associated with drug dealing and prostitution.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, they're outskirts of a city. Mm-hmm. Run down industrial areas, not somewhere you want to be living, right? And in Tokyo it's completely the opposite. But yes, the employer pays for your train pass, I don't know if it applies to part-time staff, but definitely if someone has a normal contract, that's a requirement.
Hmm. Let's talk about that aging population element. I mean, I'm jumping a bit to maybe one of the main questions about the future of this place, maybe even the present to a certain extent. Now, Japan is perhaps, I've looked at a lot of statistics over the years because I teach even on this subject in terms of global outlook. The age of the population is percentage-wise a very high chunk over 65.
I think it's due to hit somewhere around 19%, if not 20%, within 10 to 15 years. And of course, that means the classic questions of how to afford the retirement pension system, but also replacing the revenue stream in terms of taxes, you know, replacing the working population as it is. And so then come all the questions, how? Also, there's always been this discussion I've read, I love those articles, I'm fascinated, about birth rates and the difficulties with having children in this country, why relationships, how they're going, why they're not going well or are going well, or at least in terms of having children. I mean, it's a very big issue. I'm sure you see things related and also hear about it. How do you see it playing out?
Well, this is a very big issue. It's an issue which has become, I think, less of a thing globally recently. Yes, it's one of those issues that, like any issue, could be fixed with just a few small changes, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, a very interesting thing was you talked about the over 65s, and, you know, in Japan now there's a significant number of over 75s, right? So for example, in my local community, there are all these different community groups, and one of the community groups 2 years ago, they had to stop giving free membership to the over 70s because such a high percentage of the members were over 70, they weren't getting enough money to run the group.
Right. The whole senior discount thing is going to have to be adjusted.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you think, like, what are obvious solutions? Well, what every country is pretty much every modern so-called developed country is raising retirement ages.
Uh-huh. Here it's currently 65.
I think 65. I guess 65 for men, 60 for women, which is most kind of common in most developed countries. There's a 5-year difference. Doesn't really make sense when you think that life expectancy for women is higher. But, you know, just adding a few more years. So that big, you know, 65 here is still, it's young.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the health of the people, mm-hmm. you know, Japan has an amazing reputation for high life expectancy. But I think what is maybe less known outside of Japan is that the people here are fit and healthy in old age. Yeah. You know, I have many terrible memories of jogging around my local park and there's like old men running past me.
Yeah, like seven, 70
years old. The people here are very, very fit and active in, you know, really far into old age. And, you know, I think if you don't go the kind of the route that we've gone in England, where we have lots of what we call old people's homes, maybe in American English you call care homes, things like that. If you don't go that route, then I think it does encourage people to stay fit and active. So there's not necessarily the health burden. Japan also famously has a very, very efficient health service. It's often said to be not just one of the best health services in the world, but the most efficient. Japan, for example, spends much less on healthcare than the UK, and yet the standard of healthcare here is much higher. That's because in Japan, just like France, the costs of healthcare that private companies can charge hospitals, for example. So, like, a hospital might have a medical cleaning company come in to do the cleaning. The prices that they're allowed to charge are regulated by the Ministry of Health. Okay. So every 2 years, the Ministry of Health meet with a big board of doctors, and they price out everything. I mean, they price out individual pills.
I mean, this is sometimes referred to as a sort of subsidized... The government's involved in terms of keeping costs from getting too high... I don't know if subsidize is a loaded term, but...
Yeah, and also it's, you know, it's a hybrid system here. So Japan doesn't have what's called universal healthcare, which means free for everyone. In Japan, we pay into a national health insurance system. It's sort of compulsory but not enforced. So there are gaps with kind of self-employed people might not sign up for one. They should, but they might not. And that insurance policy allows 70% of the healthcare cost is paid for. The individual's meant to pay the remaining 30%. I'm a freelance worker and I'm not working at the moment, and therefore my 30% is actually capped. There's a monthly cap. I think it works out as like $235. So, you know, even though my 30% might be like $500 in a bad month, which is every month at the moment, I'd only pay $235. If you're living on welfare here, for example, it's 100% is paid. So because the healthcare system's so efficient, it's not breaking under the strain like the UK and some other countries, where you have this double thing of the obesity crisis and an aging population with a lot more healthcare needs. But an interesting issue is what are the things that are kind of not really healthcare, but the related things like in-home care for elderly people. So famously in the UK, at-home care for elderly people is not paid for by our health system, the NHS, but it is in Scotland. Because in Scotland they voted and said this is really important, we need, you know, nurses to go. Now, you know, many of your listeners have watched the documentary Sicko by Michael Moore, in which he goes, visits France, and in France, for example, when a woman gives birth, she has a certain number of visits at home afterwards, and this includes having someone who come and to cook some meals and do cleaning and this kind of, and there's a famous scene where the woman's doing the ironing or something. Well, if you think of that in the case of elderly people, you know, maybe it's very important if an elderly person's living alone. In the past, almost all Japanese people lived with their extended family. That's becoming less and less true. It's always been, I guess, not such a thing in Tokyo, because most people in Tokyo are from outside Tokyo. But now everywhere people are living away without the extended family. So there's the child care issue, which is maybe one reason, one of the many reasons why the birth rate is low and is declining, and the opposite of the care of the elderly issue. So, you know, before you had the grandparents were looking after the children, and the adult children were, you know, looking after their parents in the same household, right? And without that, you have the big childcare issues here. Child care here is quite expensive, nothing like London prices, but still relatively expensive. And you have the issue of who's going to care for the elderly. There is, like many countries, there's a looming pension crisis. Again, Japan has a... I think Japan has a hybrid pension system here, like the UK, so maybe a state pension and a private company pension. I don't pay into any pension system, and as a non-Japanese, although I have permanent residency here, I wouldn't be eligible for any state pension. But there is the obvious question of who on earth is going to pay the pension bill, and there's just clearly no money for that at the moment.
Right.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
There's no way that the people in their 20s now are going to magically get a pension in the future, because that money doesn't exist.
One of the ideas is that they're somehow, either through a boost in birth rates or which is the route that Germany may have taken, let's see how it goes, but that's certainly one of the arguments with the raising, let's call them quotas for taking in, be they refugees, be they simply immigrants, let's say, that Japan could do the same thing. The only, perhaps, well, one major difference is that Japan's relationship with immigration is perhaps not that simple. It's not a typically famous destination, although there have been groups throughout history. So, you know, taking in more strangers.
Yeah, so in Japan, immigrants tend to come from Asia, mainly China and South Korea. starting to get some, maybe Thailand and
quite a few immigrants from India, and I know I shouldn't be surprised, but I often am sort of taken aback when I'm greeted in Japanese, fluent, of course. I guess it sounds magical, and then I realize, oh, then they realize I don't know what they're saying, and they speak in perfect English, and of course they came from India.
Yeah, and like everywhere, the IT industry is fueled by Indian immigration. But again, outside of Tokyo, immigration is still very, very low. I mean, even in Tokyo, it's very, very, very low, despite what it feels like. But then, you know, what does immigration mean? Like, in Japan now, we're getting a lot of people coming to study here, and they're also working part time when they study, and in a sense, they're, you know, making quite a contribution to the economy. We wouldn't usually call that immigration, but if they're here for a standard undergraduate degree, here's 4 years, you know, maybe that's quite a significant thing. When I first came to Japan, immigrants were associated with these jobs called the Sankei jobs. San is the number three. Sankei, I forget the three Japanese words, but basically dirty, underpaid, and hard work or something. Mm-hmm. Although by Japanese standards, that means something like working in a convenience store. It doesn't mean working in a coal mine. So these were jobs that, when I first came here, young people here didn't really want to do. I guess that's changing now. A lot of young people here are working in this particular service industry now.
Oh, wow.
You know, you see...
I always assume that you just never go back. Like, if a society's youth are like, I don't do that job anymore, they'll never... But, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, Japan has gone forwards and backwards many, many times. You know, it's incredible if you think in the 1950s when The Office was first arriving in Japan in a big way. And you can find on YouTube, you know, footage of, you know, girls in their late teens on the train to move to Tokyo to, you know, to work in these office jobs and
whatever that is. Yeah, right, this new.
Yeah, you know, it was this thing like, you know, it's very interesting when you talk to Japanese people out of work. It's very, very hard to find out what a Japanese person's job is. Very, very, very difficult, because you ask them and the answer is always the company they work for. They never say what the job is, and you have to actually push quite hard to find out what you actually do. Like, when you go to work, what do you physically do? And also sometimes they use an English term for the job that's doesn't match the English definition. So I know some people here who work in the media, so you might find someone who claims to be a TV producer. Uh-huh. And when you hear about their job, it's not what normal people would consider a TV producer. Okay. You know, it's okay. It's like a general dog's body that involves quite odd bits of work that have no connection between being a producer.
Please present yourself. What is your name?
Edward.
Your full name, please.
Edward Dons.
Oh, hello, Edward Dons. Now, tell me more. How old are you?
I'm 8.
And when is your birthday?
The 23rd of February.
The 23rd of February. I see. We're still a few months away. All right. And where do you live?
In Machida.
Where is that? Because there's some people that could be hearing this. They could be in England. They could be in South America.
Japan.
Okay. So we're in Machida in Japan. Got Edward. We got a birthday, which is in February.
Evelyn live in Japan.
And what is your name?
Jukushino. Jessica.
Jessica. And how old are you? No. You can hold up.
I'm 4, but I secretly 3. I secretly.
You have a secret age? Favorite song to sing? What's your favorite song? Think about it.
Tinkle, tinkle, little star. just that.
Yeah, that's a good one. All right, little more complicated. Go back to Edward for a second. What's your favorite subject?
Chemistry.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What makes chemistry your favorite subject? What is it about chemistry?
Because you understand what things are made of and why they work.
A dream or a hope of yours?
Well, my dream is to make a medicine that can cure any type of a cancer.
So in Japan, every single person has lunch at 12 o'clock. Oh. And I guess we're getting quite close to 12 o'clock now.
Oh, that'll be interesting. We'll get
so
to hear it.
So we might see like a wave of people. It's just 12:05. So we should be seeing like waves of people. In fact, we are just as we speak.
We're coming out.
People are coming. And look, check it out. Okay, the wave is coming.
Yeah. By the way, the first thing I noticed is that they're not wearing suits, which is so far impressive to me.
Well, but it's a tech company, so it's kind of unusual, I guess.
I'm getting khakis and sweaters, which is very tech. Shirts untucked, that also is surprising. But yes, tech company, so that changes things.
Yeah, now we've got a few people in suits, although without their jackets, but yeah.
Anyway, so we've been talking
back
a bit...
to the world of work, yes.
Yeah, we've been talking about the world of work, the world of Japan, really, and the present and the future. And one thing is this, the great importance of the office job. It's part of your life. A lot of people know that term, the sexist term, the salary man. I'm calling it sexist.
Yeah, although it's the massively accurate term. The female equivalent is OL, the office lady. So
yeah.
Salary man, office lady.
Mm-hmm.
And salary man is just someone who gets a regular salary, but it basically means someone working in an office.
Yeah, and once you've got that, that opens all doors, right? In terms of having money, in terms of building your life.
And, you know, employment is very high in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Until really quite recently, people expected a job. Well, let's say men expected a job for life. The salary for men here is set to support a family. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Still, the majority of women here don't work. They're housewives. That's a very, very normal thing here. And that's starting to change. That's starting to change because, lots of reasons, but the main thing is the job for life idea is sort of disappearing.
Right. I'm very curious.
Although much slower than other countries.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm coming from the Netherlands where it feels like, and it's just a feeling, I haven't looked it up, but the average Monday, Tuesday, you're in the supermarket in the middle of the day, and you're surrounded by people. They're all freelancers. This is the time where they're going to go to the supermarket.
Yep.
They're not going to go at five. You once told me that you proudly, of course, you had a better name for it, but you don't live according to the 9-to-5 schedule, so you never have to deal with the...
Yeah, it's sometimes called temporal arbitrage.
There it is.
So, like, arbitrage is taking advantage of a difference in two things. Like, a lot of people, especially in the gig economy, are trying to do geographic arbitrage. So you earn your money somewhere like New York for part of the year,
mm-hmm.
and like allow, you know, working for maybe 4 months in New York allows you to live the 8 months in Thailand, mm-hmm. so you're taking advantage of the difference in the value of money, right? The buying power of the dollar.
Yeah.
Temporal arbitrage is, well, in my case, it's trying to live in the kind of the off-peak times.
Yeah.
But also, you know, also temporal arbitrage includes things like in the gig economy. It includes being able to work at times when other people aren't working, but that's very valuable for an employer. So if you're doing IT support work and you're the kind of person who likes to sleep in the day and work at night, you can be getting, you know, good money doing remote network support from your apartment at night time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now companies are outsourcing work to countries in a different time zone,
mm-hmm.
so they can have a continuous work day,
mm-hmm.
because maybe their Japanese employees are here from, let's say, 8 till 10 is a normal working day here.
Wow.
But when they go home, then there's all the outsourced work being done by, you know, by the Filipinos or whatever.
I did not realize it was 8 to 10.
Well, you know, you just look at what time, you know, rush hour here is from sort of 6 till half 10 or 6 till 11 at night, basically. You know, I shouldn't say this, but my sister works in the financial industry, and in the financial industry in the UK and the US, people are often talking about their 70-hour weeks or whatever, and a typical office worker in Tokyo is doing a 70-hour week.
And people considers it normal.
Yeah, working hard is the 90-hour week. I mean, it's, you know, it's a different world, really, compared to the soft Europeans.
But I'm very curious, and I'm sure they're out there, and they're, I suppose, going to grow in percentage about the, you called it the gig economy, the freelancers in Japan, and that potential clash between a society that has now been geared towards the office worker, the job for life, and this, I guess, new global trend way of work, which is more precarious.
So I think what will happen in Japan is that there won't be so much of a clash. There'll be a hybrid system. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting in Japan. The impression here is that everyone works for big companies. The reality is that legally, the vast majority of people here work for very small companies, but those companies work for the big companies. Mm-hmm. So a big car manufacturer, for example, it will have a lot of direct employees, but there will also be hundreds of small companies. I'm talking 5 to maybe 30 people.
Yeah.
Who that company basically it's one customer is the big car company.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, back to the aging population, there will also be a large number of freelance employees who are over retirement age. So these are people who worked for the company, retired, and continue to be employed as consultants. It's a very, very big thing here. So, you know, in a way, the Japanese solved the kind of potential clash of gig economy versus stable employment years and years ago, because it's been going on for quite a few years here. And yeah, Japan always, you know, Japan is very, very, very good at taking things from outside of Japan and modifying them somehow.
I just saw Coffee Coke in one of the vending machines.
Yeah,
which is exactly what it's called, Coffee and Coke.
I always forget the phrase, but the Chinese used to talk about Marxism with a Chinese flavor or something, and you know, Japan is very, very, very good at taking things and Japanese-ifying them, mm-hmm. and making them work pretty well. You know, this is going to sound very strange to a lot of listeners in Europe, but one of the reasons Japan is, you know, I hate to be positive because I'm such a negative, bitter, and cynical person. But a few years ago, I met a very, very intelligent British economist over here who was giving a talk on he was actually giving a talk on why is the Japanese currency, the yen, seen as a safe harbor currency. Okay, so the Japanese yen is seen as very, very safe, stable currency. And this guy is saying, why would that be? We've had, you know, the interest rate here is basically zero and has been for a very, very long time. Everyone talks about the zombie companies here, the stagnant economy, all this kind of anti-Japanese propaganda, basically, from the European and US media. And this guy pointed out two things. So first, he pointed out just a very simple economic fact, which is that in other countries like the UK, the rate of inflation is massively massaged. So, you know, a typical trick is they'll say, well, yes, the price of electrical goods has remained constant or is falling slightly, but actually they're much better quality than they were years ago. So we're going to put that as a massive decrease in price, mm-hmm. or increase in value, and this allows them to pull down the rate of inflation, right? So when the, you know, in England, the government might claim inflation is, I have no idea, but let's say they say it's 2.5%, and people are saying, well, I go in a store and the food's gone up, you know, 25% in the past 2 years. That's not a compound of 2.5%. So he was saying that actually in Japan, very, very low inflation and very low interest rates, and actually we've had deflation most of the time since I've been here. We've just started to get inflation. That adds up to a real but very small growth in the value of the yen year on year, whereas other countries that are claiming to pay, let's say, 1.5% interest, when you take into account the reality of the inflation. But the other thing he said, which is very, very perceptive and kind of hard to swallow, is that Japan has recognized something that Europe and America and many other countries cannot understand. And this is going to sound terrible to say this, but Japan has recognized that at the moment, for a country to work, the most important thing is to make sure there is low unemployment for men between the ages of, let's say, mid-30s to early 60s. Now, I can hear our listener shuddering and saying this is sexist, this is a ridiculous thing to say. But the facts are irrefutable. I mean, the statistics, the problems in society you get with high unemployment. And that's why Japan, when Westerners come here, they say, oh, look at all these stupid fake jobs. Why is there a middle-aged man standing next to some roadworks directing the traffic?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, as for the man versus woman thing, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's obviously something that works in this society. Would it work the same everywhere? I don't know. I would say that
I don't think it's about something working or not. It's about the problems in other societies caused by male unemployment. And you know, I'm not making any value judgment on this at all. You know, I'm not saying it's a good solution, but it's a reality.
Yeah.
And I think if people are honest with themselves, they'll recognize it as a reality in their own country.
But the other thing, the other piece to that that stuck out in my head was this, what we call this, free market capitalism, whatever you want to call it, the dominant form of capitalism, let's call it dominant, the most commonly found, the global interlocking companies, all one, basically one world economy. That one of the values of that system seems to be, where can we cut? Where can we cut costs, right? Where can we reduce the amount that we spend? And everywhere you look, well, almost everywhere you look, you see companies making decisions, and governments now, in favor of, okay, there's a person standing there that just waves around a shiny stick. They cost X amount. Well, if we wipe them out, we can just put a sign, and that'll save us money, right? And this kind of logic...
In the very, very short term, and that's exactly my point. And you know, again, I don't want to push it, but there is a gender issue here, you know, in all countries as well, that it's... If you just look at the dynamics of countries where there is high male employment, it doesn't matter how so-called progressive the society is. In England, for example, we'd say, you know, replace the person with a sign or whatever.
Yeah.
Replace the government employee with an outsourced employee. In Japan, this is something they have learnt, and it's a fact, and it's silly to argue it, but they have found that a fake job is better than all the associated costs with higher the opposite with the unemployment. They have found it is better to give someone a fake job than to have that person out of work, because the cost of having someone out of work is higher over a longer term. Now you could say it's you know.
But that cost is often a societal cost, whereas the company might say, "Hey, that's not our problem." I mean, I'm speaking now as more of what I feel like I see. Take North America, take Europe. You know.
Yeah, but Japan is the country where companies have a 100-year business plan.
Okay.
Right.
They feel like they have to worry about more than just the bottom line this year or.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Massively. I mean, you can, if you dig into it, you can see about shareholders. You know, the lack of hostile takeovers here. This kind of, you know, you'll find big Japanese companies where, that is essentially owned by a few big old families, and their business plan is multi generations. Yeah. But also there is a strong legal framework in place. So, for example, the building we're in, to get permission to build this building, they had to provide a certain number of, you know, let's be nasty and say fake jobs, right?
They have a much nicer name for it.
That's, I don't know if there is a Japanese term for it, but they have to, and that's during the construction process and afterwards. Mm-hmm. So during the construction process, that's why we see the middle-aged men and now middle-aged women as well standing outside, you know, directing people around a barrier or something insane like this. That's why, you know, so like in England, we always have a similar thing, but it's always half-hearted. So I remember a new shopping mall being built in my hometown, and part of the agreement was they would provide 100 new jobs for people currently living on unemployment benefit. This did not happen. They somehow found some loopholes around, you know, because in England,
in the name of maximizing, the
law has more holes than substance. So they somehow found a reason why, you know, or a bunch of reasons why they didn't have to, you know, do this, keep this promise. But in Japan, there's just a strong, there is a deep knowledge among government and among companies that the cost of an unemployed person is higher than the wages for a fake job.
Yeah. I guess I always assumed that I'm kind of excited at the idea that it's not a done deal, it's not a guarantee, it's not, I always assumed that the inevitable relationship, almost like gravity, was it may take some time, but everywhere businesses will fall on the idea of who can we cut? How can we cut? Where can we cut? And it's interesting to see that, I mean, I know there are always examples of countries that resist, companies that resist, but here perhaps even an entire society that says, that's not how we do things.
Yeah, and you know, we have to remember Japan is very, very significant in the world. We might, you know, it's, Japan is a very, very powerful but invisible force in the world. You know, depending on how you measure, third largest economy on earth, right? And this is a country with, I don't know, population is 160 million or something here, right? There's just a, you know, a bunch of people crowded on a tiny island. Japan is a massive investor abroad. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to remember. When you're in Europe, when you're in the US, when you're in England particularly, it's very difficult to understand and accept that you're not the whole world. Mm-hmm. And you know, even though the numbers are obvious, right? The Chinese are like a billion people, yeah, right? Yeah. That's very significant, right? What China does, how it behaves, how it thinks, as a country, as a group of individuals, very, very significant. It's a bit like, you know, when you're in England and you are listening to music and you're listening to very popular music and you think, oh, this is very popular music. And then you find out that like in Europe, there's some guy you've never heard of who sold 500 times
Engelberg Humperdinck. And I never understood.
You know, well, a lot of it will be a language issue. The European pop stars,
David Hasselhoff, understood that one.
You know, well, but European pop stars who record the same song in five European languages,
right?
Or you'll find out, like, you know, I think one of the biggest non-fiction the biggest fiction authors of all time in the world is some German sci-fi author.
There it is.
And again, it's because of the translations going Europe. So you know, just in the way that America doesn't understand it's becoming less relevant compared to Europe, because, you know, the French economy is not particularly huge compared to the US. The European economy, very, very significant compared to the US. But when you start to think about China, Japan, India, I mean, these dwarf Europe and the US combined in terms of population, in terms of spending power, and they may not think the same as Europeans and Americans.
Right, right.
And, you know, one of my pet hates is San Francisco. I hate San Francisco.
An essay by Matthew Dunst.
Although I very much love my dear friend Mitch in San Francisco. Absolutely. But in San Francisco, that you know, there's very much a feeling that, like, they're where it's at, and the world is inevitably going to get to that point.
Oh, everybody wants to be who they are.
It's just going to happen. Uh-huh. It's just going to happen.
I sometimes worry that I live in the San Francisco of Europe.
Exactly. And you know, and in a way, you know, that idiot Francis Fukuyama who said, this is the end of history, right? And you know, the American neocons, right, documented in Power of Nightmares, right, by Adam Curtis.
I knew we'd get there.
You know, about sort of, you know, basically whatever happens in the world, eventually, you know, neoliberal kind of free market economics, you know, that's, you know, mild Christianity, that's where, because, you know, it's already tied. Not wants to be is not that, it's that it's an inevitability disconnected from desire, right? It's not about what, just this is the way this is the way humans, and when you're outside of Europe and the US, it clearly isn't the case. You know,
we're brought up to think that whatever version of capitalism, or never mind capitalism, the version of economics that we see happening, playing out in Europe or wherever you grow up, especially in the West, that's human nature.
And as inevitable as, you know, as anything else. And, you know, sometimes people here describe Japan, Westerners here describe Japan as the communist country that works, right? But in a way, you could also describe it as a capitalist country that works.
And
it is a very interesting hybrid. And yeah, when you're here, when you're in Asia, you just feel it's not inevitable. The narrative provided in the US and the just the variation on it provided by, you know, in Europe, there's a very deep belief in bureaucracy, right? Something that maybe we should be a little bit skeptical about in Europe, because, you know, it wasn't so long ago bureaucracies were sending Jews to the gas chambers, right? In Japan, amongst Japanese people, there's always this big idea of copying and learning from other countries. But always here, I'm thinking, like, what should other countries be learning from Japan? You know, what are all the things that, you know, that people do get right here? And, you know, again, I hate being positive, but the standard of living for a really large percentage of the population here is very, very high. You know, for the past 15 years, there's been a very, very strong narrative in Western media that the Japanese economy is stagnant. And that, I think that really goes deep into the falsehoods that we're taught, that we are taught about economics, and this misunderstanding that, you know, the movement of money for its own sake is somehow a wonderful thing. And the erroneous belief that we can believe any economic figures told to us by governments, which, you know, being British, we clearly can't. You know, in England, the economy is a lie. Absolutely.
The facts can be used in all kinds of ways. Exactly. And you see it every election.
The mismatch between what we're told in the media and the reality of people's daily life, I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
you know, all throughout Japanese history, there's been this thing of new ideas come and you take the bit you want and don't take the bits you don't want. Mm-hmm. And a bit like in, so in South Korea, the standard of English is much, 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 much higher than in Japan. And it's because they embrace Christianity to such an extent, and they were all being taught English by the American missionaries. And, you know, now, yeah, standard of English is very, very high, whereas in Japan it's embarrassingly low. Mm. And, yeah, always in Japan. So, you know, the attitude to religion here is very, very fluid. Japan is a, you know, on the surface, a secular society, but people here are very superstitious. We're always told the two main religions here are Buddhism and Shinto. The reality is that those are just two aspects of a general religious belief here. It's not that there are people here who are Buddhist and people who are Shinto. It's that there are people here who will do Buddhist ceremonies for, you know, a whole bunch of religious public holidays and deaths and births and this kind of thing, and yet, you know, they'll be going to the Shinto shrine to pray to pass their driving test or high school entrance exams or get the promotion at work or whatever. It's a very, very, very fluid attitude here. Yeah. And it just ties into this thing of, you know, obviously Buddhism came here from China. Shinto was the native paganistic religion. Shinto's polytheistic, so... and it, Shinto is also is sort of animistic, whatever it's called.
Oh, animistic.
Animistic. So the idea that, you know, there's like a god of needles that's in the needles or whatever, because you know, needles were a very valuable thing, and or whatever, you know, just like the animists, you know, would believe that if they tripped on a tree root, it was that the tree root was alive and had moved to that place or whatever. But yeah, there's always this idea of you just take the aspects you want. It's not seen as any kind of contradiction. It's not seen as crass, I guess, even with cultural stuff. Yeah. When I was at university in England, I had a lot of Japanese friends, and many female, because at the time there was this thing that the male university students wanted to go to the US for the sports. The female came to the UK, but I don't know what they wanted.
The education.
the education, maybe. And I would always say to them, oh, what's the best thing about being at university here? Thinking, you know, or being exposed to hardcore feminism or environmental movements, or, you know, being able to drink on campus, because in England you can drink at the age of 18, or being able to take drugs or whatever, you know, you can try cannabis or all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And they all of them said, I can wear the same clothes for several days. Whereas at university in Japan, I feel I have to change my outfit every day.
Right.
You know, they love being able to wear jeans.
Yeah.
And, you know, the feeling that they could wear jeans. And I found that quite upsetting and distressing. I was like, come on.
That's the thing out of everything.
That was the thing, you know, that you think that they have sacrificed a lot to be here. Their parents have made big financial sacrifice to be here. And a big thing for them is to kind of feel they could wear what they want. And, you know, again, I don't want to push the gender thing here, but when you talk to women about their appearance here, they are very, very much dressing for other females. Very, very much. So when people, for example, talk about the highly sexualized clothing of young females here, when you talk to them, their prime interest is looking good for themselves and their friends. Right, it's not a thing of want to impress the boy, attract the boys. Yeah. It's like, you know, the prepubescent girl here wearing the suspenders and low cut top. It's like, this is what's called kawaii, which is cute.
Yeah, I hear that all the time.
Cuteness is a big thing here.
Yeah.
So the two big dominant things are kirei, which kind of translated as beautiful, but what really means is clean.
Okay.
And kind of almost what I would call stark. Uh-huh. So they want things to be kirei, so, you know, putting concrete on a mountainside is Kid A. You know, they say, well, it stops landslides and it's Kid A. And then the other thing is kawaii, the cuteness. So what I, you know, what I would say, very, you know, these incredibly sexualized clothes, it's like, it's kawaii, it's cute. And it's, they're wearing it for them, for themselves and their female peer group.
Yeah.
So, you know, chicaneness is something that's doesn't sit well with our ideas in the West about you know, how stuff works.
Right. Yeah.
But interesting topics.
Yeah. All right. Well, Matthew, let's go. The list could be long, but I'll quickly mention the 100 yen
store.
Store, that's gonna
maybe
be
Yoyogi Park, which is the, I think, one of the biggest parks in central Tokyo. Used to be an American air base, I guess, after World War II.
And I'm gonna, I'm
and maybe Harajuku, right? Where, you know, so near Yoyogi Park, there's Harajuku. There's a famous street called Takeshita Dori, or the the fashion Harajuku fashion comes from. Yeah, let's head over there.
Sounds good.
Cool. Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Ah, the dulcet tones of the Haichiko bus, the little mini bus decorated like a dog that rides around Shibuya, gets you from and to the places where the metro doesn't go. Shibuya, the place where we recorded this interview, that was Matthew Dons. I really strongly, I urge you to go to MatthewDons.org and donate, because Matthew is in a fight for his life. I know people often use these terms, fight for your life, but no, this is actually a fight for one's life, to get treatment that is expensive and could give him more time with those two beautiful little people that you heard briefly in this recording, with people that you didn't hear in this recording that mean a lot to him and for whom he means a lot. You can make a difference, so please do. Link in the show notes, MatthewDons.org. I've got more interviews with Matthew that I will release over the next few weeks. But meantime, citizenreporter.org, that's the classic, that's the channel. Gonna pump some new life into it over the next year, 2018. My plan is CTRP back in force and pushing a lot of the programs that I'm now working on back here, back home, to where it all began and where it all still continues. So thanks for listening. I leave you with the sound of rain and whatever else goes on in Japan as I was wandering around. You never know what you're going to hear. This one is probably rain. And I'll talk to you real soon. Thanks for listening. See ya.